So let's begin this morning's sutta reading here. And I, first of all, I'm going to just reply to Chi Wei's question from yesterday about the future perils of the Dhamma, because I mentioned only one of them yesterday. And he was asking, what are the other ones that are in this particular sutta? And the other future perils listed here, one of them is when somebody gives ordination to somebody else, and the person who gives the ordination is not developed in body, virtuous behavior, mind, and wisdom, then you can expect that the pupil too will not be developed in body, virtuous behavior, mind, and wisdom, because you don't know how to discipline or to train that person in those qualities if you haven't got them yourself. And then there is a second point, is if the teacher, this is a case where you don't actually ordain somebody, but where somebody takes dependence on you. And this is like in monasticism, it's like when somebody who has a different ordination teacher comes to you and they say they want you to be your teacher, then they take dependence on you. And this is what is meant here. And if somebody comes and takes dependence on you, again, if you are not developed in these ways, then the student too is not going to get that development, because you don't know how to teach them, basically. So you can see how everything here is around. You have to develop yourself if you're going to be able to propagate that Buddhist teachings, whether it's to your students or just through your teachings as such. And the third one, it says here that if you're not developed in body, virtuous behavior, mind, and wisdom, then if you engage in talk on the Dhamma, you will tend to slide down into a dark Dhamma without recognizing it. And this seems to mean, according to the commentary, it means that you get into disputation and arguments about the Dhamma. It's that famous simile of the snake, which is in the Majjhima Nikaya 22, whereby you're grasping the Dhamma in the wrong way. It's like grasping a snake by the tail, and the snake turns back and it bites you instead of you being in charge of the snake. The snake bites you instead. In the same way, if you grasp the Dhamma in the wrong way, in fact, you are actually causing suffering both for yourself and others rather than causing happiness. Another way of understanding this, perhaps, is that the dark Dhamma means that you have wrong view, and you're actually not teaching the Dhamma properly at all, because you haven't really realized it, because you are just going by your own best judgment of what the Dhamma is and what it isn't. You may actually teach the wrong thing. And that may be what is meant also by dark Dhamma in this case. That's another peril for the future. And the last one is when monks, again, are undeveloped in body, virtuous behavior, mind, and wisdom, they become luxurious and lax, leaders in backsliding, discarding the duty of solitude. They do not arouse energy for attaining the as-yet unattained, for achieving the as-yet unachieved, for the realization of the as-yet unrealized. And then the next generation will follow their example. People tend to do what their teacher does. So if you have a teacher who is lax, you will also tend to become lax. That's just the way things are. So in all of these cases, all of these five cases, the basic problem is that the person is not developed in body, virtuous behavior, mind, and wisdom. And that is how all these other negative consequences come about. So that is the kind of the main, the kind of overall message of this particular sutta. And the other sutta, there was about the five causes and conditions for the decline of the Dhamma. I left out two, and they don't really have much additional to say. This is very much related to the way the Dhamma was taught at the time of the Buddha, in the sense that you repeat it verbatim, and you learn it by rote learning. So the two last ones here are about you do not make others repeat the Dhamma in detail as they have heard and learnt it. And the bhikkhus do not recite the Dhamma in detail as they have heard and learnt it. So it is not, I felt it wasn't that relevant to how we learn the Dhamma these days, because we have books, etc. Anyway, so that is the things that I left out yesterday, just for your information. And now I want to move on to going from why we shouldn't read the Dhamma to some more real Dhamma issues. And the first thing I want to talk about is the noble truth of suffering. What this suffering actually means. And I'm going to start off very gently with a few very kind of easy to understand suttas about what suffering is in life. But at the same time, in my opinion, also very useful suttas. It's somehow, for me, when you read something which is very simple and very basic and easy to understand, it often hits home in a very powerful way. Because it is just so obvious that this is true. And yet, most people never even think of these most obvious things. And that is why it can be so powerful. So this first sutta is called Born from Those Who Are Dear. It's from the Majjhima Nikaya. And you will soon see, find out what this is all about. So this is how it goes. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was staying near Savati, at Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. Now at that time, a certain householder's dear and beloved son, his only child, had died. Because of his death, the father had no desire to work or to eat. He kept going to the cemetery and crying out, "Where are you, my only child? Where are you, my only child?" Then he went to the Blessed One, and having bowed down to him, he sat to one side. The Blessed One then said to him, "Householder, your faculties are not those of one who is steady in his own mind. Your faculties are deranged." "Lord, how could my faculties not be deranged? My dear and beloved son, my only child, has died. Because of his death, I have no desire to work or to eat. I keep going to the cemetery and crying out, 'Where are you, my only child? Where are you, my only child?'" "That's the way it is, householder. That's the way it is. For sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear." "But Lord, who would ever think that sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear? Happiness and joy are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear." So the householder, not delighting in the Blessed One's words, rejecting the Blessed One's words, got up from his seat and left. Now at that time, some gamblers were playing dice not far from the Blessed One. The householder went to them and said, "Just now, sirs, I went to Gotama, the ascetic or contemplative, and having bowed down to him, sat down to one side. He then said to me, 'Householder, your faculties are not those of one who is steady in his own mind. Your faculties are deranged.'" And then the whole conversation is repeated. And then down to, "That is the way it is, householder," said the gamblers. Now the gamblers are talking, "That is the way it is. Happiness and joy are born from those who are dear. Arise from those who are dear." Then the householder left thinking, "I agree with the gamblers." So you can see here how this, it's remarkable how how he can be in denial even of the most obvious fact that he is so completely out of his mind because of the death of his son. He doesn't eat, he doesn't work. And yet when the Buddha points out to him that this is suffering because of somebody beloved to him, he just rejects it out of hand and says, "No, actually, it's happiness and joy that are born from those who are dear." Even when it's straight in your face, people refuse to see these most obvious truths in a sense. And that makes it such a powerful teaching, because sometimes life is like that. The most obvious things in life, we don't want to have anything to do with it. We don't want to see it because it is too challenging for the way we normally lead our lives. And the vast majority of people in the world will think, I think, precisely like this householder here. And you can understand the gamblers down the bottom here. I just finished off with, I think the gamblers here they are like it's like a metaphor for the average person, somebody who gambles, just an ordinary person out there. I think they're a metaphor for that. And the point here is simply that, well, this is the way the world generally tends to think, that happiness and joy are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear. But of course, the question arises in this particular case. Isn't this householder right to some extent that also happiness and joy does arise from those who are dear? We all know that there is a certain happiness from people who are close to us, from family members and close friends. Surely this householder must also be right. It's not as one-sided as you might think it is straight away when you see this, that it's all suffering and misery. That's not true. We know from experience that there is also a lot of happiness to be had as well with people who are dear to us. And this is where this very beautiful teaching of the Buddha, where he talks about the three aspects of any kind of experience, is very useful to remember. He talks about any experience in life, anything that we deal with, can be viewed from three different perspectives. It can be used from the asada of something. Asada means like the happiness or the pleasure or the gratification in something. That is one way of understanding something. And almost anything in life has that aspect of gratification or pleasure in it. And certainly our friends, our family members, all the people who are dear to us, we can very clearly see that asada there, that pleasure of their company, etc., etc. The other aspect of anything in life is the adinava. The adinava means like the danger or the disadvantage in something. And this is closely related to the suffering in life. And of course, what the Buddha is pointing out here is the adinava, the danger in those who are dear, the other side of the coin, so to speak, what we're talking about here. And the point, the Buddhist point of view, is of course that in the end, the adinava, the danger, the suffering in these things is greater than the happiness. The suffering in the sensory world is greater than the happiness that comes from going beyond these things. And this is a kind of a fundamental Buddhist thing that you will see in many suttas. You have, for example, the well-known sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya called the Sutta on Suffering, the Mahadukkha Kanda Sutta, the greatest sutta on the aspects or aggregate of suffering. And it talks about the various ways of suffering in the world. And the Buddha always says, the adinava, the danger, is greater than the happiness and the pleasure. And the way you can see that in this particular case is that no matter how dear somebody is to you, no matter what sort of relationship it is always going to go only in one direction. It's always going to end in one particular way. It's always going to end in separation. It's always going to end in not being able to see that person anymore. And so the problem is that the better your relationship is, the more attached you become to that person, the more dear they are to you, the greater is the suffering when eventually you have to separate. And that is the problem in life. You know, we don't want bad relationships. What's the point of having a bad relationship? That is suffering in its own right. And yet, even good relationships must end in suffering. And that is the adinava, the ending point. The goal of these things is always suffering, always trouble. And you can see here, I'm sure you can all recognize the emotions that this man is going through. He has no desire to work or to eat. Well, this is grief. You know, when grief is very strong, very profound, that's how you feel. You lose all interest in the world around you. It's a very powerful and very overwhelming feeling. And to the point where people sometimes commit suicide because of grief. Or you know as well, you know that people who sometimes have been married together over a long life and their husband or wife dies. It's quite common if they had a good relationship and they're both quite frail, that the other one will die soon after the first one, because often they simply lose that will to live, to go on, because life is meaningless when your life's partner has passed away. So this is what is meant here. So remember this, that there is, when the Buddha says here that suffering and pain arises from those who are dear, it is not to be taken as a one-sided statement. It also, there also is that happiness there. The point is, you have to keep these things in perspective. And then the third aspect that the Buddha talked about, which all phenomena can be understood in terms of, that is the nisarana, the escape from things. So when you see that things have a limited satisfaction and gratification, and you understand that the adinava, the suffering is greater, well then you search for the escape. And that escape, of course, is found through the Buddhist path. First of all, you understand that it's worthwhile escaping, and then you search for that escape that the Buddha promised exists from all these suffering phenomena of the world. So if you look at it in this way, I think you get a kind of broader picture what this is about. So then the gamblers, having agreed with this man that surely it is just happiness and joy from those who are dear, in a sense this is like the world agreeing with the man, he's taking the world as his witness rather than listening to the Buddha. In a sense, you can say that he is so overwhelmed by sorrow and grief that he's not able to listen to the Buddha. He is not in the right state of mind. You have to have some clarity sometimes to be able to see these things. So one is much better off when one is not in the middle of grief to understand these things. Okay, so then the story goes on. Eventually, word of this conversation made its way into the king's inner chambers. Then King Pasenadi of Kosala addressed his queen Malika. Malika, your ascetic, your contemplative Gotama, has said this: sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear. And then she replies, if that was said by the Blessed One, Great King, then that's the way it is. And the king says, no matter what Gotama the ascetic says, Malika endorses it. If that was said by the Blessed One, Great King, then that's the way it is. Just as a pupil endorses whatever his teacher says, saying, that's the way it is, teacher, that's the way it is. So too, no matter what Gotama the ascetic says, Malika endorses it. If that was said by the Blessed One, Great King, then that's the way it is. Go away, Malika, out of my sight. So presumably he's getting a bit jealous here because she is listening to the Buddha, whereas perhaps not listening to him as much as he would like. Of course, at this point, the point here is also that Malika, she's already a disciple of the Buddha, whereas King Pasenadi seems not to be a disciple at this point. So one of the things about this sutta also, which is very powerful, it shows you how this queen Malika is able to teach the king the Dhamma so that he actually understands and he also becomes a disciple of the Buddha. That is like the background, in a sense, the background narrative to this story here. And she was obviously quite a wise woman, and she goes on, you can find out now how she actually turns the king around to understand what's going on. So then Queen Malika called the Brahmin Nalijanga. Come, Brahmin, go to the Blessed One and show reverence in my name with your head at his feet and ask whether he is free from illness and affliction, is healthy, strong, and living in comfort, saying, Queen Malika, Lord, shows reverence with her head at your feet and asks whether you are free from illness and affliction, are healthy, strong, and living in comfort. And then say, Lord, did the Blessed One say that sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear? And whatever the Blessed One says, remember it well and tell it to me, for Tathagatas do not speak what is untrue. Yes, madam, the Brahmin Nalajanga responded to Queen Malika. He then went to the Blessed One, exchanged courteous greetings with him, sat down to one side, and said to him, Master Gotama, Queen Mallika shows reverence with her head at your feet and asks whether you are free from illness and affliction, are healthy, strong, and living in comfort. And she says further, Lord, did the Blessed One say that sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear? That's the way it is, Brahmin, says the Buddha. That's the way it is. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear. It may be understood in this way how sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear. Once, in this same Savatthi, there was a woman whose mother had died. Owing to her mother's death, she went mad out of her mind, and wandering from street to street, crossroads to crossroad, she would say, Have you seen my mother? Have you seen my mother? It is in this way it may be understood how sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear. And then the Buddha goes through a whole sequence of relationships. In each case, the person dies, and in each case, the consequence is the same. Once in the Savatthi, there was a woman whose father had died, whose brother had died, whose sister had died, whose son had died, whose daughter had died, whose husband had died. And in each one of these cases, owing to the death of that person, she went mad, out of her mind, and wandering from street to street, crossroads to crossroad, would say, Have you seen my husband? Have you seen my husband, my father, my brother, etc.? It is in this way, too, that it may be understood how sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear. And then the same thing again. Once in the Savatthi, there was a man whose mother had died, a man whose father had died, whose brother had died, whose sister had died, whose son had died, whose daughter had died, whose wife had died. Owing to the death of each one of these, or any one of these, he went out of his mind, he went mad, and wandering from street to street, crossroad to crossroad, he would say, Have you seen my wife? Have you seen my mother, my father, etc.? And it's in this way, too, that it may be understood how sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear. So there you are. It's a very simple, straightforward teaching, and yet how powerful it is, and how applicable it is for everybody, basically. It is so to the point, and yet most people will tend often to be in denial about this reality and are not ready for it. They haven't prepared for it. So when it comes, because they haven't prepared for it, they will fall into precisely this trap, that they will sorrow and they will lament and they will feel terrible because of this. And the more you prepare yourself, the more you are ready by practicing the Buddhist path, the less these sort of events will affect you. They may still affect you a little bit, at the very least, you have reduced the power of these events to affect you in your life. Okay, the Buddha then goes on. Once in the same Savatthi, there was a woman who went to her relative's home. Her relatives, having separated her from her husband, wanted to give her to another against her will. So she said to her husband, These relatives of mine, having separated us, want to give me to another against my will. Whereupon he cut her in two and slashed himself open, thinking, We will be together in the afterlife. It is in this way, too, that it may be understood how sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear. So this is like a, if you call it a crime of passion, they sometimes call this, where you are so close to somebody that you kill yourself and you kill them, and you're hoping that perhaps in the future life you will be together. Then the Brahmin Nalijanga, delighting in and approving of the Blessed One's words, got up from his seat, went to Queen Malika, and told her all that had been said in his conversation with the Blessed One. Then Queen Malika went to King Parsenadi of Kosala and said to him, "What do you think, great king? Is the Princess Vajiri dear to you?" So Princess Vajiri here is his daughter, right? The daughter of the king. "Is she dear to you?" "Yes, Malika, Princess Vajiri is dear to me." "And what do you think? Would sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress and despair arise in you from any change and alteration in Princess Vajiri?" "Malika, any change and alteration in Princess Vajiri would mean an alteration of my life. How could sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress and despair not arise in me?" So the point here about change and alteration, this is a kind of a euphemism that was used in those days in India. Basically, it means somebody dies. That's a change and alteration. Or perhaps also somebody getting very seriously ill, getting close to dying. That's also called a change and alteration in these kind of passages. And then the king says, well, if that happens, of course, that would be mean an alteration in my life. Again, meaning that he will descend into sorrow if that were to happen. And then Malika goes on. "Great king, it was with reference to this that the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully awakened, said, sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear." And then she goes on. "Now what do you think, great king? Is the noble queen Vasabha dear to you?" And she goes, does the same thing for all these different people. "Is your son, General Vidudaba, dear to you? Am I dear to you? Are the countries of Kasi and Kosala dear to you?" Kasi and Kosala are the countries over which the king rules. "Yes, Malika," the king says in each of these cases. Coming down to the last one, "the countries of Kasi and Kosala are dear to me. It is owing to Kasi and Kosala that we use Kasi sandalwood, that we wear garlands, scents and ointments. And what do you think, king? Would sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress and despair arise in you from any change and alteration in Kasi and Kosala? Malika, any change and alteration in Kasi and Kosala would mean an alteration of my life. How could sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress and despair not arise in me? Great king, it was in connection with this that the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully awakened, said, sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress and despair are born from those who are dear, arise from those who are dear. So that is how the Queen Malika explained to her husband the king what the Buddha was talking about when he was saying that sorrow, lamentation and pain comes from those things that are dear to you in life, even the kingdoms that you rule over. If maybe you lose those kingdoms, if you no longer rule over them, then you will suffer because of that, and that also would be bad news. And the king replies, "It is wonderful, Malika, it is marvelous how deeply the Blessed One penetrates and sees with wisdom. Come, Malika, give me the ablution water." This is like the water you pour over your hand to make a special like offering or a ceremony of a ritual purity, basically, used in those days. And then King Parsenadi of Kosala rose from his seat and, arranging his upper robe over one shoulder, paid homage in the direction of the Blessed One with his hands in Anjali and exclaimed three times, "Homage to the Blessed One, accomplished and fully awakened. Homage to the Blessed One, accomplished and fully awakened. Homage to the Blessed One, accomplished and fully awakened." So that is how Mallika started the journey of the king Pasenadi, becoming a disciple of the Buddha. And of course he became a very staunch and very strong disciple of the Buddha. And it all seems to have started in this way. It's quite interesting. That last sentence there, homage to the Blessed One, that is, of course, is the Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. That is famous line, Buddhist line down the bottom there. Okay, everybody happy with that sutta? It's quite simple, quite straight to the point, but personally I find it very powerful, and it sort of drives home some very basic but very important lessons about what suffering really is in life, and how important it is to contemplate these things. It's easy to forget sometimes how strong the suffering can be when somebody close to you passes away. When life just goes on ordinarily and we are happy and content, we forget that these things must come eventually one day. And we forget how incredibly powerful it can be and how overwhelming the emotions can be. To the point, as it says here, that you cannot even eat, you cannot work, because you're so distressed by the fact that somebody close to you has died. Okay, so move on to the next sutta. And this is another of my favorite suttas, which I like a lot. It's this kind of sutta which, for me, again, is very powerful. It reminds you of some of the very basic things in life. And this sutta is about death and about the importance of remembering death. And again, it's between the Buddha and King Pasenadi of Kosala. Again, there's a lot of good suttas with King Pasenadi. And it will be a couple of more, I think, later on as well. And this sutta goes as follows. It's called the Simile of the Mountain, and it's at Savati. Then, in the middle of the day, King Pasenadi of Kosala approached the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, the Blessed One said to him, as he was sitting to one side, "Now where are you coming from, great king, in the middle of the day?" Now the middle of the day is not the time when people usually would see the Buddha. Usually they would come in the evening, and that's why the Buddha is a bit surprised, and he asks him, "Well, why are you here in the middle of the day?" And King Pasenadi responds, "Just now, venerable sir, I have been engaged in those affairs of kingship typical for head-anointed Katiya kings, who are intoxicated with the intoxication of sovereignty, who are obsessed by the greed for sensual pleasures, who have attained a stable control in their country, and who rule having conquered a great sphere of territory on earth." So here is the king basically being very honest and open about what it is like to be a king. And what it is like here, first of all, he says that he is a head-anointed Katiya king. So these are the real kings of India. These are the kind of hereditary kings. The Katiya caste, of course, is what at that time in particular was probably the most powerful caste in India. And they have inherited that position from their forefathers. So they are the real kings of India. And it says here, they are intoxicated with the intoxication of sovereignty. Sovereignty like the power and the influence and basically the power that you have as a king, that you use. And they are intoxicated with this. Now the word for intoxication here in the Pali is mada. And that word is exactly the same word as you find for being intoxicated by alcohol in the fifth precept. So the point, of course, here is that if you are in such a position, in any position of power of control, or even if it is just sensual pleasures, whatever it is, you tend to forget yourself. You lose your mind to a certain extent. You get intoxicated, basically. Just as alcohol makes you lose your bearings, makes you not see clearly anymore, in the same way, you get intoxicated by this power. So he's very honest here with the Buddha as to what is happening here. And then obsessed by greed for sensual pleasures. Again, of course, if you are the king, you have all kinds of sensual pleasures available to you. And again, it's like an intoxication which clouds the mind. You cannot see clearly what is truly important in life. You cannot understand what really matters. And you tend to focus on all those things which do not actually really matter in the long run. And he has attained stable control in the country, and who rule having conquered a large territory. So again, you know, this is just to show the power of this king, that he is in charge, he is in control, and he runs this large area. And then the king understands that this is not a good thing for the king to be intoxicated in this way, that this is bad. It means that he will make all sorts of stupid decisions and make all kinds of mistakes because of his intoxication. So the Buddha then tells him, "What do you think, great king? Here a man would come to you from the east, one who is trustworthy and reliable. Having come to you, he would tell you, 'For sure, great king, you should know this. I am coming from the east, and there I saw a great mountain, high as the clouds, coming this way, crushing all living beings. Do whatever you think should be done, great king.' Then a second man would come to you from the west, saying exactly the same thing. And a third man would come to you from the north, again saying exactly the same thing. Then a fourth man would come to you from the south, one who is trustworthy and reliable. Having come to you, he would tell you, 'For sure, great king, you should know this. I am coming from the south, and there I saw a great mountain, high as the clouds, coming this way, crushing all living beings. Do whatever you think should be done, great king.' 'If, great king, such a great peril should arise, such a terrible destruction of human life, the human state being so difficult to obtain, what should be done?' 'If, venerable sir, such a great peril should arise, such a terrible destruction of human life, the human state being so difficult to obtain, what else should be done but to live by the Dhamma, to live righteously, and to do wholesome and meritorious deeds? I inform you, great king, I announce to you, great king, aging and death are rolling in on you. When aging and death are rolling in on you, great king, what should be done? As aging and death are rolling in on me, venerable sir, what else should be done but to live by the Dhamma, to live righteously, and to do wholesome and meritorious deeds?'" So, this is the simile of the mountains that come crushing everything. And of course, the point here is that the mountain comes from all sides, from everywhere. There is absolutely no escape. There's no direction where you can go. Regardless of what happens, those mountains will crush you sooner or later. There's nowhere for you to go. And that, of course, is a metaphor for death. It's a metaphor for getting old. You cannot escape this thing called old age and death. It is just like these enormous mountains coming crushing you. And you can see straight away, as soon as the Buddha says this to the king, something happens in the king's mind. And this is the power of this thing that we call maranasati, the recollection of death. And when we recall death, when we understand that this is going to happen to us, that it could happen soon. We don't know when it's going to happen. It doesn't matter if you're young. It doesn't matter if you're old. These things happen without little warning, coming out of the blue. You just don't know when your time is up. When you think like this, it clarifies your mind. The purpose of Maranasati is to get rid of all the stupidity, all the intoxication of our ordinary lives, all the petty little angers and upsets that we have, all the stupid desires that come in our life, all the clouding of the mind that comes as a result of just being preoccupied by all the things which are not that important in the face of death. And you can see this is what's happening here with the king. His mind gets clear, it gets clarified. He understands that all this stupidity that he's ordinarily occupied with, even for a king. And you might argue that the king's affairs of state are important compared to many of the things ordinary people do. And yet even the affairs of state of a king are insignificant in comparison to death, in comparison to the big picture that we have to look at. And this is the Dhamma. This is the wonderful thing about the Dhamma. It gives you this big picture. It gives you a different way of looking at life from the way most people look at life. And it is necessary. It's only when you look at that big picture that you can make wise decisions as to what is really important, what really matters. And you can throw away all the rubbish which doesn't really get you anywhere in the long run. And this is one reason why it is important to understand that whole picture of the jigsaw puzzle. Because when you understand the whole picture, only then can you make decent, good decisions as to how and what you should be using your life to do with your life. So then, the Buddha, having reminded the king about what really matters in life, what is really important, then the king goes on. And now he shows here that he has understood how insignificant all the ordinary things that he usually deals with are in the face of death. And the king says, "There are, venerable sir, elephant battles fought by head-anointed Kattiya kings who are intoxicated with the intoxication of sovereignty, who are obsessed by greed for sensual pleasures, who have attained stable control in the country, and who rule having conquered a large sphere of territory on earth. But there is no place for those elephant battles, no scope for them when aging and death are rolling in. Why worry about elephant battles? Why worry about beating your neighboring king? Why make lots of bad karma when you know that in the long run it is only going to lead to suffering and pain for yourself and also for others? In the face of death, all of these things are so insignificant. And the larger picture of many lifetimes, of maybe even getting out of this mess altogether, comes to the fore instead. There are, venerable sir, cavalry battles fought by head-anointed Kattiya kings. There are chariot battles, infantry battles, etc. All of these things. But in all of these cases, there is no place for those battles, no scope for them, when aging and death are rolling in. In this royal court, venerable sir, there are counselors who, when the enemy arrives, are capable of dividing them by subterfuge. But there is no place for those battles of subterfuge, no scope for them, when aging and death are rolling in. In this royal court, venerable sir, there exists abundant bullion, gold, and gold stored in vaults and depositories, and with such wealth we are capable of mollifying the enemies when they come. But there is no place for those battles of wealth, no scope for them, when aging and death are rolling in. As aging and death are rolling in on me, venerable sir, what else should be done but to live by the Dhamma, to live righteously and to do wholesome and meritorious deeds?" So it is, great king. So it is, great king. As aging and death are rolling in on you, what else should be done but to live by the Dhamma, to live righteously, and to do wholesome and meritorious deeds. This is what the Blessed One said, and having said this, the Fortunate One, the Teacher, further said this: just as mountains of solid rock, massive, reaching to the sky, might draw together from all sides, crushing all in the four quarters, so aging and death come, rolling over living beings, Kshatriyas, Brahmins, Vaisyas, Sudras, Chandalas, and scavengers. They spare none along the way, but come crushing everything. There is no ground there for elephant troops, for chariot troops and infantry. One can't defeat them by subterfuge or buy them off by means of wealth. Therefore, a person of wisdom here, out of regard for his own good, steadfast, should settle faith in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. When one conducts oneself by Dhamma, with body, speech, and mind, they praise one here in this present life, and after death one rejoices in heaven. So that is the sutta of how the Buddha teaches. Basically what he's teaching here is Marana Sati, the recollection of death, to the king of Kosala. It's amazing that even kings were able to take in this kind of Dhamma in those days. They weren't so preoccupied with the riches and all the things they had, that they still had enough capacity to take in the Dhamma, understand the Dhamma as well. This teaching is very powerful, and I would recommend you to sometimes use this kind of reflection on death. For example, if you feel that you are particularly restless, or the hindrances in the mind are very strong, then just recalling that you're going to die, you don't know when it's going to be. Sometimes, not always, but sometimes it can sober you up and clarify things for you, and actually make you quite peaceful if you do it properly. But as with so many things in life, it is something that you need to practice. Even just recalling death, reminding yourself that it could happen tomorrow, who knows? You just don't know when it's going to be. Just keeping plugging away at that, thinking about it again and again, makes it into a force in your mind. And it's only when these things become a force, they become a power, something really, that is when they become really useful. And you can actually bring it to mind, and they will dispel all the confusion, all the cloudedness, and you can use it as a powerful aid in your meditation practice. And you will find that when you read the suttas, when you read the word of the Buddha, Marana Sati, recollection of death, it's something which it talks a lot about. It is a very powerful teaching. It is something which is very useful. And it is when the Buddha recommends it like that I personally tend to take it very seriously, because then you know that it actually is. It sort of gives it that authority, that power, when the Buddha himself taught it like that. That is, I've gone on for almost an hour now, just talking and reading the suttas. I'm going to stop there for this morning. Does anybody have any questions or comments or anything before we continue with the meditation? Is everybody happy? They're quite simple suttas. There's nothing too profound here, or rather it is very profound in the sense that it's quite difficult to attain. But to understand what's going on is relatively easy, at least.